Heute zu Gast der Chef des Red Bull Formel 1 Teams, Christian Horner.
I think, you know, if you're a competitive person, it's all about winning. You know, Red Bull is in Formula 1 because it wants to win. It wants to take on, you know, the giants of the sport and beat Ferraris, beat Mercedes, you know, beat the manufacturers. And I think, you know, we've demonstrated that we can do that, and we've done that consistently. So, yeah, it's all about winning, and winning drives everything else. Your bottom line always looks better when you've got a winning car. Let's go! Go!
Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Weil die Kolleginnen und Kollegen von Instafo, also der Jobplattform für den Tech- und Sales-Bereich, von der ich hier schon häufiger berichtet habe, mittlerweile bei uns doch groß engagiert sind hier im Podcast. Ihr hört immer wieder hoffentlich von Instafo. Deswegen habe ich die Kollegen vor kurzem mal selber persönlich kennengelernt und war wirklich sehr angetan. Sie haben mir also dazu erzählt, es gibt eine neue Finanzierungsrunde in die Firma. 10 Millionen werden da investiert. Das ganze Thema wird also immer relevanter. Daher nochmal hier mit Nachdruck der Hinweis: Wer Menschen sucht im Bereich Tech und Sales, denkt an Instafo. Die haben da scheinbar wirklich eine neue magische Soße gefunden, wo sie über ihre Plattform ein automatisiertes Matchmaking zwischen Arbeitnehmer und Arbeitgeber ermöglichen. Und das ist im direkten Marktvergleich dreimal effektiver, was die Quote von Bewerbung zu Einstellung angeht. Hilft natürlich auch, dass sie bereits über 100.000 passende Talentprofile auf der Plattform haben und dass man sehr, sehr schnell ins Gespräch kommt. Innerhalb von 48 Stunden bewerben sich die ersten Talente bei den Arbeitgebern, oder man kann sogar als Arbeitgeber einer vorselektierten Gruppe an Talenten aktiv eine Nachricht schicken oder sie zum Chatten einladen, um sich noch schneller kennenzulernen und zu prüfen, könnte das passen. Also nicht nur ich und die Geldgeber offensichtlich glauben an Instafo, sondern auch mittlerweile über 1.800 Firmen, darunter O2, RTL, HelloFresh, MyPoster, viele, viele weitere. Instafo ist auf OMR Reviews best bewertet, 4,8 Sterne in der Kategorie Recruiting-Plattform. Firmen, die nun Instafo ausprobieren möchten, sehr gerne. Ihr spart außerdem 500 Euro auf die erste Besetzung, wenn ihr euch anmeldet über Instafo mit Doppel-F, instafo.com/OMR. Zurück zum Podcast. Ich könnte mir vorstellen, vielen Hörerinnen und Hörern ist gar nicht klar, wie erfolgreich die Formel 1 aktuell weltweit ist. Denn der Erfolg in Deutschland ist ja ein bisschen zurückgegangen nach Schumacher und Vettel. Aber weltweit ist es eine Riesennummer. Die Formel 1 wurde vor kurzem verkauft. Mittlerweile gehört sie zu Liberty Media. Vorher war ja der Bernie Ecclestone eine der führenden Figuren. Und das Ganze ist auch ein Riesenerfolg für die Teams, die daran teilnehmen. Unter anderem halt Red Bull. Und das Team von Red Bull wird geführt von Christian Horner. Der ist früher selber Rennfahrer gewesen, dann Manager geworden oder Teammanager und jetzt halt von einem Helmut Marko, einem Red Bull-Manager, angesprochen worden, vor vielen Jahren schon. Und hat jetzt aktuell den Weltmeister Max Verstappen, fährt für Red Bull. Aktuell pausiert die Formel 1, aber in ein paar Tagen geht es wieder los. Und im Vorgriff darauf wollten wir halt sprechen über diesen weltweiten Erfolg. Wo kommt er her? Welche Rolle spielt Netflix? Welche Rolle spielt digital? Welche Fragen ergeben sich übrigens auch aus dem Klimawandel? Und den Herausforderungen natürlich dafür für solche eine Sportart. Nicht gesprochen haben wir im Detail über die Ukraine-Situation, auch die Rolle von Bernie Ecclestone, da gab es ja einige Äußerungen von ihm. All das war dem Christian Horner, glaube ich, während unseres Gesprächs gar nicht bewusst und ich habe ihn auch nicht darauf angesprochen. Wir haben auch vor einigen Tagen schon aufgenommen, also das bitte nur für den Hinterkopf. Ansonsten war ich total positiv überrascht, wie wenig PR der Christian Horner gemacht hat. Ich dachte erst, naja gut, der ist ja nun wirklich Profi, alle 14 Tage mal mindestens irgendwo eine Pressekonferenz. Seit Jahren weltweite Aufmerksamkeit ist er gewohnt. Selber übrigens auch ein Celebrity, über 1 Million Instagram-Follower. Verheiratet mit einem ehemaligen Spice Girl, mit der Jerry Halliwell. Also der weiß, wie man mit Medien umgeht. Aber trotzdem war er extrem offen, fand ich. Hat ein paar Zahlen fallen lassen, ein paar Anekdoten erzählt, die man, glaube ich, so noch nicht gehört hat. Und damit direkt rein ins Gespräch mit Christian Horner. Welcome to the OMR podcast. Last year we spoke a lot about soccer. This year we'll be speaking a lot about Formula One. It starts with one of the biggest names in Formula One. He's the mastermind behind Formula One, Red Bull Racing. He's Christian Horner. He doesn't speak German. His name sounds German, but he's British. Hi, Christian.
Hi.
Explain to us a little bit about your journey into Formula One. I mean, everybody knows your name and you're a household name almost in Germany, but I don't think everybody knows like the way how you got there.
Yeah, well, as you said, I have a German sounding name, but unfortunately, you know, I've lived in the UK all my life. I'm not aware of any German heritage, but I started my career as a driver. You know, I started racing in karts when I was 11 years of age. Then I progressed into car racing, in racing, you know, single seater race cars. So full of, through the various formulas, Formula Renault, Formula 3, Formula 2. I created my own team in Formula 2. I raced for it for 2 seasons just to get it established. And then, really ran the team as I would have liked to have driven for a team. And, I had a lot of success with that. I won the championship for 3 years in a row, racing against, Dr. Helmut Marko's team.
Okay.
Which was my first, even before that was my first introduction, you know, to him. I bought a trailer from him back in 1996 when I first created this team. And then I ran a Red Bull Junior driver in 2004, Vit Antonio Liuzzi, alongside Dutchman Robert Doornbos, and again dominated that championship. So I was looking at the next step, you know, to go into Formula One. Bernie Eccleston was pushing me very hard to buy what was at the time the Jordan team. I had some investors that were interested in getting involved in that. And then Red Bull, became the primary option for, the Jaguar team. And once they'd acquired it at the end of, in November 2004, they came to me and said, well, look, why don't you come into this project with us? And, because they wanted to change the management and put their own mark on it. And so, the deal with Jordan was becoming ever more complicated. So I decided that, you know, I'd take up this position with Red Bull. I was only 31 years of age. So it was an exciting project to be and get involved in, you know, right from the very beginning.
But you never became an investor into the team, right? I mean, like, your other option would have been to, like, look for money yourself and become an entrepreneur yourself. Like, the way it's set up now, my understanding is you are basically, in the end, is it an employee position within Red Bull, or how would you consider that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I'm the CEO and team principal of the Red Bull Formula One activities, but the shareholders, you know, 100% shareholders are Red Bull GmbH. So, I report to Mr. Matuszewski and obviously the board in Red Bull.
But do you sometimes regret that you don't became an investor yourself? I mean, there was such a value development around those teams lately.
Yeah, but Formula One's a very expensive game also, and I think that the value is really coming into the franchises now, it would have been just too expensive in the previous years to get involved in, you know, in the sport. The demand for sponsorship and revenue is so high. It would have been very, very difficult to have made, for example, the Jordan project, you know, successful.
At the time, what kind of cost were you looking at for a team at that stage, like a couple of years ago, and versus today? What's like, just be able to understand it economically a little bit better, what type of value are you looking at?
I think at the time you were talking about a valuation of the Jordan team. Eddie was trying to value it around 15, 16 million pounds. So, and if you think, you know, today's teams, the top team is in excess of $1 billion.
Wow. So that would be like the Red Bull team now, or the Mercedes team is like over $1 billion?
You've got to assume that with where Formula One is, with the revenues that come into the sport, that, in excess of that, you know, for a top team.
Wow. Wow. And maybe one last question to your journey, to your past. Like, your talent as a driver, would that been enough to drive in Formula One yourself, like open and self-critical? Were you just like the wrong circumstances, or would you say like you are a better manager than a driver?
I was okay as a driver, but there were lots of drivers that were okay. You know, I raced against, you know, my era was Juan Pablo Montoya and Nick Heidfeld and, guys like that. But, I, the higher you get, the harder it becomes. And, you know, I was okay, but I was only ever average. I was not good enough to be a good Formula One driver. I tested in Formula One for the Lotus team back in the early 90s in 1993. But it gave me a fantastic insight. It gave me, you know, a great experience and a feeling and understanding.
Okay, but I mean, it would have been enough for like the middle or the back of the field or the pack, but not for like be a championship driver.
Absolutely, even the middle of the pack. The standard in Formula One is so high that, you know, I loved the time that I had driving. I drove against some great drivers. You know, there was some wonderful talent at the time. Drivers like Tom Christensen was racing, and who else? You know, I was racing in karts against Jarno Trulli and Giancarlo Fisichella and these guys. And actually, I raced against Max Verstappen's mum, Sophie Klumpen, in the very late 80s, 1989. I did the Junior World Championships in karting and was racing against, you know, Max's mother.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay. I mean, I'm asking a little bit because it sometimes feels like there is a path to Formula One as a driver that is basically money. I mean, there's those paid drivers where, you know, there's always these stories of people that sort of like buy a seat, and it feels like, you know, that is not a talent question then.
No, look, I think Formula One or motorsport is just generally very expensive from karting all the way through. And, you know, I had to work very hard to raise sponsorship to fund, you know, my driving career. So again, it was another education for me that, you know, I had to go and sell myself. I had to sit in front of, you know, company management and convince them to invest in me, to invest in motor racing. So that was, again, it was a great experience. And then running the team, you know, I'd be booking the hotels, I'd be doing the tax returns, I'd be paying the salaries, I'd be helping to wash the truck. You do all the jobs. And I think it was a great education for me because you get to experience all aspects, you know, of running and operating a team.
What's the team like today? I mean, what kind of company are we looking at in terms of revenue, employees? Just give us a feeling of what type of economic thing we're looking at there.
Well, you see, Red Bull is such a big entity in Formula One. And of course, we have, you know, Red Bull Racing. We have Red Bull Powertrains now, the new venture for the future Formula One engine. We have Red Bull Advanced Technology. We have encompassing America's Cup and the Valkyrie and other projects. And then we have Red Bull Technology, which is the supplier of technology to AlphaTauri as well as our own Grand Prix team. So there's many different divisions of, you know, within the Red Bull Formula One group. But, you know, it employs approximately, you know, 1,200 people.
Wow. Okay.
You know, we have revenues that are probably around, you know, €500 million, you know, per annum. So it's a big business. It's a competitive business. And of course, it's diversified from not just Formula One, but into other projects like, you know, designing the Valkyrie, like the America's Cup project, like, you know, bikes that we're working on with BMC and so on. So it's fascinating how the business has really, you know, evolved from what Red Bull bought from Jaguar at the end of 2004.
And the America's Cup, that's sailing then? Is that the sailing project?
Okay. So that's the Red Bull Alinghi partnership. So we're supplying, you know, technology and know-how to that project. You know, with a specialist knowledge that we have, whether it be simulation or aerodynamics, for example.
Okay. And what's the main revenue source? Is that sponsoring in the end?
We have a significant amount of sponsorship revenue, you know, approaching, you know, half the figure that I just mentioned. And then, of course, the television revenues are significant. You know, through the distribution of the prize fund in Formula One. And then of course all the different projects and engineering projects that we have. So we have a combination of revenue streams.
Okay, but sponsoring is the most important one.
Sponsorship. I mean, obviously, we've announced a title partner for this year with Oracle, but then we have a roster of over 20 partners. Some of which are new for this year, but it's a great makeup of different partners from all categories.
Okay. And how did this grow so much? I mean, some of it seems like the general growth of Formula One. I mean, the whole industry grew, like it became a really, truly global sport. But I mean, what was the main drivers of that growth?
I think competitiveness is important. Being able to offer a real return on investment is is crucial. The B2B work is between some of our partners as well is a key factor. But then success on track drives that interest. And then of course the growing popularity of Formula One because of the competitive racing, because of things like Netflix that have taken Formula One to the people. We've got a whole new fan base coming in. America has suddenly fallen in love with Formula One and woken up to Formula One. So that drives different revenues, different funding streams into the business.
Would you attribute that American that success in the US to Netflix mostly? I read studies how like there's now I think two races already happening in the US. Yeah. They're thinking about a third one. There's like so much TV interest in the US now. Is that all because of Netflix in the end?
I think fundamentally it's because the show has been good and the racing has been competitive. But you see, what if something like Netflix does is it gives you a glimpse behind the scenes into the characters and the personalities of the drivers and the teams and the competition. And I think it's really ignited, the interest in America. And we've seen that go exponential the last, the last few years. So I would say Netflix has played a key role in bringing in a new fan base and also a much younger fan base, into Formula One.
When you first heard about the project, were you skeptical or were you like, immediately were you like, okay, let's do that, that's awesome?
Well, the first approach was actually to do it just on Red Bull.
Oh, okay.
So we were talking, I was talking to the production company that produces it and said they approached us if they could spend a year, with us as a fly on the wall. And then Formula One said, actually, we don't want to do it with just one team. We want to do it with all the teams. And so they came back to me and said, look, this is Formula One's position. Would you be okay with that? I said, well, it's better you do something than nothing. So we were involved, very much from the very beginning. And in the first year, of course, Ferrari didn't get involved. Mercedes wanted to do their own deal with Amazon. And they stood back and then they saw the value of what it brought, and then they came in series two.
Okay. I mean, you said that competitiveness of the product plays a huge role. I mean, even Netflix, I mean, they have the distribution, but they still need something to show. That's amazing too, that catches people. But I mean, now, like, with the exception of this year, I mean, obviously now this year was your year, but the years before, it wasn't that close. It seemed like it's an established ranking, almost like the German Bundesliga, where you have one champion and it's the same one every year.
Yeah, and serial winning is boring. It turns people off, sport. We saw it in the Michael Schumacher era. People will claim the Sebastian Vettel, era, even though two of those championships went to the last race against Fernando Alonso. But I think that what this series has done has definitely ignited the interest, and it's shown some of the some of the politics, some of the personalities, some of the challenges, behind the scenes that isn't just based on the racing.
Okay, but I mean, you need those sub stories in order to create tension, because the big story was always.
And so, of course, then you get a golden year like last year, the most competitive year in Formula One for the last 40 years, where every weekend you had Max and Lewis like heavyweight boxers fighting. Yeah. Across 22 different rounds, and that then is, box office for the promoters, the broadcasters, and subsidiaries like Netflix.
I mean, how much was the last year different than the years before in terms of attention? Was there like twice the attention? Was it? I mean, is there any proxy that you can mention where you're like, okay, it's totally changed. Like the last year was like on a different level.
Yeah, last year was way more intense. When we won the World Championship with Sebastian, it was tough, but it was all about what was going on the track. It was stressful, but it was nothing like the intensity of, you know, last year. Last year, there was so much politics away from the circuit and so much tension on the circuit. And it was so close between the two teams, the two drivers. And of course, the Mercedes have dominated everything the previous seven seasons. So nobody had challenged them, you know, like we had. And so the intensity of that battle was, you know, was huge all the way to the final race, which then in itself had its own controversies, you know, surrounding it. But, you know, to come out of the year beating Lewis and becoming world champions for the fifth time as drive with a driver champion in Max, was an unbelievable season and feeling for us.
But I mean, even though sometimes you lose, doesn't it feel like, I mean, the end of the product is good. I mean, how much is like the real passion for winning and how much is your passion for just producing a good product? I mean, even like the Mercedes guys must know that even though they lost, they were like part of an awesome product. So does that soothe it in a little bit? Or is it like, are you like racing guys just all about winning?
I think, you know, if you're a competitive person, it's all about winning. And, you know, Red Bull is in Formula One because it wants to win. It wants to take on, you know, the giants of the sport and beat Ferraris, beat Mercedes, you know, beat the manufacturers. And I think, you know, we've demonstrated that we can do that and we've done that consistently. So, you know, it's all about winning and winning drives everything else. Your bottom line always looks better when you've got a winning car.
I mean, but your sponsors or Mercedes sponsors, they must be happy anyways. I mean, they got the attention, they got the reach they were hoping for probably nevertheless. My question is, what do you pitch them? I mean, like how do you convince somebody to advertise or to work with you? What's the best argument?
It's a very compelling story because I think, you know, Formula One, you know, even compared to the Olympic Games and the Football World Cup, you know, we generate bigger audiences. And I think, and those, of course, happen every 4 years, whereas Formula One is every 2 weeks. So, you know, the demographic of what we reach, the global reach that we have, the countries that we perform in, the television figures that we generate, the eyeballs through social and digital media that we generate, when you're looking for a return on investment, Formula One actually is very, very cost effective. So for, you know, somebody like an Oracle or an ExxonMobil or a Tag Heuer, or, you know, particularly for a Red Bull, in terms of a marketing platform for the reach that Formula One has, it's the biggest sporting entity in the world.
Kleiner Hinweis für die neuen Ziele. Und zwar Pipedrive kennen wir bei OMR auch sehr gut. Das CRM-System insbesondere für die Förderung des Wachstums kleinerer Firmen. Pipedrive ermöglicht es ganz einfach, den Überblick zu behalten über Vertriebsaktivitäten, Gespräche, Abschlüsse. Man verpasst keine Nachfassaktion. Pipedrive ist vor allen Dingen einfach zu bedienen, vollständig anpassbar auf die jeweilige Firma, auf die jeweiligen Teams und erstellt sehr hübsche visuelle Berichte. Darüber hinaus gibt es zahlreiche smarte Automatisierungen. Also geht zu pipedrive.com, um dort eine kostenlose 14-tägige Testversion zu starten. Zurück zum Podcast. What's the best placement that you can offer? I mean, obviously, like the team name now is Red Bull, which is like, you know, in itself a sponsor. But after that, like what's usually with you, but in general in Formula One, probably the best, like the most important placement that you have?
Well, I think title partner. So for example, bringing Oracle in this year, we become Oracle Red Bull Racing. So they have prominent branding on the side pods, on the drivers and so on. And so again, the eyeballs of coverage that they will generate through the branding that they have in all the territories that we race in and are broadcast in is enormous. It's monstrously huge.
Can you like give us at least an estimate of what's that worth? Like an Oracle, is that like a 9-figure investment for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a significant number for them, and it's a long-term investment as well. And it's great that an American company like them have seen the value of Formula One and chosen to invest in it. And of course, it's also the perfect place to showcase their product, their technology, their cloud computing, or their fan engagement, with making use of all of their software and all of their tools. And that applies to all of our partners, whether it's Tag Heuer or a PokerStars new for this year, or an Arctic Wolf, or a HP or Siemens, or the list is pretty lengthy. But it's great that we've attracted these brands to supplement Red Bull.
And do you do that like in terms of outbound sales? Do you approach them and tell them, look, what we have here, don't you want to talk with us? Or is there like a lengthy inbound waiting list of people that want to talk to you and discuss with you?
Well, we're very fortunate that we are able to pick and choose the partners that we want to work with. So you're always looking for the right fit. It's not just about the sticker on the car. Sometimes it's about the technology that's in the car, as well. So it's about having the right fit of partners for the brand that we are. That are like-minded, that share the same goals, the same vision, the same attributes. And so we're in a fortunate position. We can be a little bit choosy, particularly in recent times that, there's a huge demand for Red Bull.
What's the role of the driver? I mean, understandably, the technology plays a huge role. And I mean, from the outside, one understands that you can only win with the right car. So it seems like the car is even more important. But then what's the role of the driver in general, like for winning and becoming a brand?
Well, the driver is a crucial ingredient. He's a key part. And all these drivers are phenomenally talented, but the cream always rises to the top. And I think in Max Verstappen, we have currently the best driver in the world. He is obviously the world champion, but I think as a 24-year-old, you see he's in his ascendancy. Lewis Hamilton, the most successful driver of all time. Again, a phenomenal talent. And you saw those two guys raise themselves to a different level last year. They were, ahead of the whole rest of the field, taking blows out of each other every race from Bahrain to Abu Dhabi. And it was a phenomenal thing to see, and the variance that a driver can create. I mean, of course, the car is hugely important, and they wouldn't, neither Lewis nor Max would win in a car that was from P9 or P10 on the grid. But the cream always rises to the top, and those guys set themselves apart from the rest of the field.
At what point can you tell that a driver is like a Red Bull driver that has special talent? I mean, as you just said, that like a driver in P8 or P9 can't win. I mean, how do you identify like that talent? Is it just you see it and at the track you stand there and you notice, okay, that guy is different? Or what makes you, how do you scout talent in that way?
Well, we invest a lot in young talent. We have a lot of drivers coming through the junior programs. So Red Bull have always been very active in that side of thing, led by Dr. Helmut Marko. He's always been very keen on nurturing and bringing in new and young and exciting talent. And so you get an idea as they're coming through the lower Formula, but it's not until they get to Formula One and indeed they get to a front-running seat that suddenly the pressure, the scrutiny of the media, the pressure of being in that seat, the expectation that comes, that you see how these drivers deal with that pressure. And, they either sink or swim. And we do our best to train them before they get to that level. But a driver like Verstappen, for example, it's at the big pressure, the high pressure moments that you see them really stand up. And it's like in any sport, whether it be tennis or football or whatever, it's only when the pressure is on that you see, how much mental strength, how their aptitude is under those high pressure moments.
what's the relationship within Formula One between like the two top teams? Obviously, all the attention, all the, you know, excitement is around like Mercedes and you mostly. And then there's like a lot of other teams and a lot of other drivers. Is that like 80-20 rule? You are 80% and the rest is 20%. How would you like break that down? And what's the role of like a number 8 or number 9 team in your hierarchy internally?
Well, I think obviously there's an intense rivalry, and certainly was last year between ourselves and Mercedes. They're based 20 miles from our factory. There's a huge competitiveness between the teams, and Toto Wolff and myself are very different people. We run the teams in very different ways, but that rivalry, that there's a respect, but it's a hugely intense rivalry. And of course, we've got, you know, Ferrari are a phenomenal team, so much history. We expect them to be fully competitive this year. And you know, maybe one of McLaren could throw a surprise as well. So different dynamics, but like in any sport, there can only be one winner. You've got different teams with different qualities, and ultimately there can only be one winner.
But is it a completely different business for like a number 8 team than it is for you? I mean, they probably have like half the resources. They have like basically no chance of winning at all. So it's a different industry almost that you are in, and that like a number 5, 6, 7 team is in.
Well, it's the same between a Manchester City and a Norwich City in the Premiership. You know, you have a big difference, and you know, whether it's the same in the Bundesliga as well. So yes, of course, it is a very different challenge for the teams that are fighting for survival at the bottom of the field, that just by getting through the season is their biggest result and still being there, compared to the teams at the front of the field that are, it's all about performance, it's all about winning.
And how far is the Mercedes approach and the Toto Wolff approach different than yours? I mean, you just mentioned that you both follow a different approach.
I think Toto is, he's a much more corporate guy than I am. He's a bit more remote from the team. We operate still very much as a race team. I'm here in the factory today. If I'm not at the racetrack, I'm in the factory. I think that, you know, we run as an agile team that has the ability to respond quickly, react quickly, and be very proactive in our decision taking, that we've been very agile in our ability to take decisions and change path or direction. Mercedes have built a much more corporate machine. As a result, they're much more process probably driven than we are. So it's not to say that one is right or one is wrong. They're just very different philosophies.
Okay. How did you observe yourself becoming a celebrity almost? I mean, you have, 1.4 million people on Instagram that follow you. You're like in these shows. You're like now like a global person, thanks to Formula One, thanks to Red Bull. How did that develop for you? How did that change your life?
I mean, obviously working in Formula One, within the Formula One world, everybody knows who you are. I think the biggest difference now is because of the global reach of Formula One, and things like, you know, the Netflix show, suddenly your face becomes a lot more familiar. You forget that, you know, you forget that you're just a normal guy, you know, doing your job, and then, you know, somebody wants to come up and have a selfie or a picture in it. It still surprises you. My wife obviously has had to deal with that throughout her.
I know.
Yeah. So, but it's, you know, we're just incredibly grateful to the fans, and without the fans, there is no Formula One. So, I will always take the time to talk to the fans, or take a picture or an autograph, because without them, there is no sport.
But it feels like, I mean, the top names in Formula One, if you like rank them, it's obviously Lewis Hamilton, then it's Max Verstappen. And then it's almost like Toto and you. the faces of the sport, and even though you're not driving, I mean, that's basically like a new development in general to that sport, or is that a wrong perception?
I think it's just how things evolve, and I think it's the competitiveness between the teams and the drivers, and you know, the higher you rise, the sharper the knives become. So you know, you've always got to keep your feet on the ground.
Okay. Well, but I mean, but you're like managing your Instagram account now appropriately, and you're like, you know, do you do personal branding deals yourself? I mean, is it, do the brands work with you exclusively?
No. Everything I do is through the team. So, you know, we have some great brands that we work with, but it's, you know, obviously digital media is a great way of keeping in contact with a fan base, and it's so accessible, it's so immediate, it's a great way of communication.
What's the KPI that Red Bull looks at? I mean, they invest a lot of money, they set it all up. Obviously now it seems like they get, you know, a lot out of it, but I mean, they don't look at it that blunt. They want to like probably know like more details. What's the steering KPIs that you have to work against in order to make Red Bull happy? They don't want to just win. They want to like get something back for the investment, right?
Yes, but the on-track performance drives all the returns. So the key KPI is where we are on track, because that dictates everything else. It dictates your television time. It dictates all the financials. So the biggest thing that we're gauged on is on our performance, because it drives everything else.
So you don't keep track of like how many eyeballs you've reached like every day, every week?
We generate a huge amount of data, and so you can always measure that, and there's no substitute for winning.
Which one do you look at there? I mean, like outside of winning, I mean, obviously that's like the sport itself, but like, is there any like metric that you look at that you like follow and like, oh, wow, that's bigger than before, or like that's dropping off? And like, what do you follow?
Well, I think fan engagement for us is huge, and I think we're seeing that we now have more followers in Formula One than any other team, across the different platforms, across the people that we're engaging with, and also the demographics of who we're engaging with is incredibly important, you know, for us, that it has to be inclusive. So, you know, obviously we're generating all of these metrics, which is all fascinating data. But the biggest thing that drives that is how you perform on track and how you, you know, how you handle yourself.
Okay. You mentioned that you've met Bernie Ecclestone very early on in your career, and he tried to convince you to get involved in Formula One. How do you perceive the whole development in Formula One itself? Obviously, it doesn't, you know, it's not a Bernie Ecclestone run business anymore. It belongs to investors now. What did change there?
But obviously, Bernie, you know, such an incredible character. He built the sport. You know, he created the business. He took it in the early 1970s from almost amateur status into a global business, generating billions of dollars worth of revenue, and as a truly global championship. But as anything in life, you know, time moves on and it evolves, and I think. Obviously, the business was sold to Liberty Media, and they brought in a whole new approach, opening up, being more inclusive in terms of their digital media strategy, in terms of how they work with partners and sponsors. And I think that, you know, the world keeps evolving, it keeps changing, and the way that people look at content these days is very, very different to what it was 10 or 15 years ago, or certainly when I was growing up, that, you know, there's so much more choice. You know, when I grew up in the UK, there was four channels. Now you've got millions of channels plus YouTube, and I look at how my children look at content, or they look at sport, or they interact. It's very different to when I was, you know, to when I was a kid. So, and I think Liberty have embraced that, and I think, you know, that's been a positive thing.
Ihr seid ja hoffentlich alle am 7. und 8. Mai beim OMR-Festival in Hamburg mit dabei. Das freut dann nicht nur mich, sondern auch die Kolleginnen und Kollegen von Audi. Denn unser Partner Audi bietet dort die Möglichkeit, Audi und vor allen Dingen Elektromobilität zu erleben oder zu erfahren, im wahrsten Sinne des Wortes. Ihr könnt dort den Audi Q6 e-tron, der Mitte März erst seine Weltpremiere gefeiert hat, dort kennenlernen. Ihr könnt Probefahrten machen mit verschiedensten vollelektrischen Modellen wie dem Audi Q4 e-tron. All die Fahrzeuge
sind vor Ort. Um das zu machen, benötigt ihr noch nicht mal, ganz leise, ein Ticket fürs Festival. Ihr könnt einfach unter audi.de/omr schon vorab eine Probefahrt reservieren. Oder wenn ihr ein Ticket habt, dann könnt ihr zum Audi-Stand kommen in die Halle A4 und dort eine Probefahrt ausmachen. Jedenfalls kombiniert gerne eure Reise zum Festival nach Hamburg mit dem Erleben von Vorsprung durch Technik. Zurück zum Podcast.
Can you like pinpoint one or two or three decisions they've taken that were different from the Bernie Ecclestone era? I mean, maybe that the other sports can learn from, like in terms of rights, or what were the most striking differences that they allowed or that they wanted from you, or that how did they change the game?
Well, I think the biggest thing was that they embraced digital media. They saw, you know, Bernie always questioned digital media because he didn't see it as a revenue generator, whereas I think Liberty saw it as an advert to then drive eyeballs and interest in the sport. So it was just a different philosophy. Bernie was very much always of the view he was selling steak, not hamburgers. So for example, the Netflix deal, he would have never have entered into because the revenue that they pay for those rights is very modest. But then you look at the reach that's created, and then the secondary revenues that's created. For example, you know, I don't believe we would have bought Oracle in as a title partner without, you know, that initiative, or all the promoters are full, sold out audiences and looking for bigger bigger grandstand capacity. So it's just a different philosophy. It's a different way of operating.
And does he like agree with that today? I mean, you seem to talk to him once in a while still. I mean,
I see Bernie regularly, and you know, he's still very much in touch with what's going on with the sport. He obviously still has a great relationship with all the promoters. With Stefano Domenicali now as the CEO of Formula One, he has a good relationship with. So he's much more prevalent now than he was, say, 4 or 5 years ago.
And how is your relationship to Liberty? I mean, obviously, like, you're an important part of their product, and vice versa. How is that relationship, and how often do you talk to them? How can you imagine that?
It's very good. Obviously, I don't need to talk to them so much. My main interface is through their CEO, you know, Stefano, who I've known for 20 years, you know, racing against, and when he was at Ferrari. But you know, Chase Carey, Greg Maffei, all those guys, they're keen to see Formula One succeed, and it's great to see that they still have a real passion for it.
In terms of global expansion, what's the next step? I mean, obviously there's like the US border seems to, I mean, obviously that seems to be like now a Formula One market after decades. Is there like another market, another expansion level that you're looking at?
Well, we've got to get back into China. So it's really important, I think, as a market for us. I also think, you know, there's so many race places that want to host a race, whether, for example, South Africa, or desperate, to host a race, or even Argentina, you know, other Latin American countries. So I think Formula One is in a great position that it can also be quite choosy about where does it want to host its 23 races in a year, because there's so much competition from different markets.
What do you hear in terms of teams? I mean, there's rumors there might be new teams stepping in. I mean, even German brands are like at least, you know, in the rumor. Anything that you hear there?
Obviously, lots of discussion going on at the moment. And it's great that Formula One is generating that interest, and it just shows the relevance of Formula One. So I think the more prestigious brands are involved in Formula One, the better.
Okay, but you don't expect any newcomers soon?
I think the most obvious entry point is 2026 with a whole new engine.
Okay.
And so, you know, 2026, we've got a new engine, new chassis, new car, new Concorde agreement. That would be the obvious entry point for any new manufacturer.
I mean, one of the obvious questions is, I mean, with all that success and all the development that you see, it sometimes seems a little contradictory, if you can say that, to like what's happening in the world. I mean, everybody's like, it's very climate conscious, it's very like thinking about the carbon footprint and all this. Is that, I mean, surprising to you yourself that like Formula One is doing so well in these times?
Yes, but we're also taking it very seriously. So, when you look at the efficiency of these cars, are quite incredible in terms of the range and fuel consumption that they're achieving, with the performance and horsepower they're delivering, is something that we're very bad at promoting. From an efficiency perspective, of course, we're introducing, biofuel content this year, which will go up to 100% sustainable fuels in 2026. So I think Formula One is a development bed for technology, has demonstrated time and time again with some of the best and most talented engineers in the world. That it's a driving force of technology.
But you still, like, if you would agree that if you do a SWOT analysis of the Formula One, like, one of the major weaknesses or threats is that it has this, I mean, it's hard to argue that it's very, very climate conscious.
I think it's something that's a key thing on our radar, and that's why the new engine and powertrain has, been a lot of collaboration with the manufacturers to say, okay, does this fit your criteria? And I think the overwhelming response has been yes, particularly with the use of sustainable fuels, with an increase in electrification, hybridization. So I think that that's a key factor that we're very conscious of.
Do you follow the developments around different racing series around like electric vehicles or that? Is that something that could also be a threat to you?
From a distance, I think you can see, electric racing isn't really working. It doesn't engage the. There's no noise. There's no passion. There's no atmosphere really to it, and you now see manufacturers withdrawing from that championship. So I think it's great as a technology tester, but again, sometimes that technology has to be questioned. When you've got diesel generators charging batteries, sometimes it's what's going on behind the garage doesn't represent what it's representing in front of the garage.
Okay. Which sport do you see like closest to? I mean, what do you compare yourself to? I mean, you mentioned the Olympic Games, the Soccer World Cup. Any like other sports that you look at, like the NFL, football in the US? Anything that you try to learn from that you look at, that's maybe even a competitor?
I think you can always learn from all sports. I think that American sports, they put on an incredible show. It's about real fan engagement and entertainment. You only got to look at the Super Bowl. For that. And I think you can always learn. I think in any business, it's important to be open-minded, to look at other sports and never feel that you're an exclusive club that knows everything.
Okay, but so you say football is probably the best managed sport, like in terms of attention and global brand worldwide?
I'd say, football is very inclusive, isn't it? I mean, anybody can kick a football. And I think, football, you see such a big following globally for, I think, Formula One after that probably, is probably the second biggest sport in the world.
Okay. I mean, that's the problem with racing, right? I mean, it's so hard to imagine what it's like. So for you, people have this experience. I mean, it's not comparable to car driving. It's as a sport, nobody has ever done it. I mean, it feels like there's like billions of people watching it, but nobody has ever done it.
Yes, but then it's also about these incredible drivers that are almost like modern day gladiators that strap themselves into these unbelievable machines and then go and race each other at ridiculous speed. I mean, it's mind blowing, and particularly when you see these cars in real life, the energy that they have, the performance that they generate, you can't believe that a human being can control it at that speed. They're like fighter pilots.
There was a lot of talk here in Germany because there's a football game now coming to Germany for the first time. An NFL game is going to be played here. I mean, you have that in London as well. Is it is this the live event, like attending a live event? Is that important to you, or is it basically a TV sport and it doesn't matter? You don't even need to go because the experience on the TV is better than that in the live venue. I mean, what's the role of the live venue?
I think it's a combination of both, because I think people feel the atmosphere from the live event. So it's got to create the right atmosphere, the right buzz, because that then transmit. Of course, it's all about the eyeballs. But if it doesn't look like a venue that you want to be at, or you don't, when you watch the event, think, I'd like to be there. Wow, that looks incredible. That's what it needs to transmit. That's what it's got to convey.
Is it like that? I mean, do you hear that? Like, people come there and they be like, okay, it's a different thing.
That's why countries like Singapore or Abu Dhabi, Formula One is such a spotlight for that weekend on that territory. And when you see the night race in Singapore, the amount of people say, wow, that's, I want to go there. Or Melbourne or any of the other venues that we go to, it's putting a spotlight on their country for that period in time. And of course, that's why countries and states get behind Formula One, to invest in Formula One as an advert for their own territory.
I mean, they pay a lot of money to get a race. I mean, that's how it works, right? I mean, you have to like pay like millions. And there was a huge discussion in Germany because, we had like two races. Now then one was taken away, and then it came out like how much money certain cities paid for that. What's your favorite race in the calendar?
I think it's great races. I mean, there's so many different venues, but some of the old school circuits, the best ones, anywhere there's a big city is a lot of fun. So as I say, Singapore's a great race. The Japanese circuit is unbelievable. The Belgian circuit's unbelievable. But even other races like Montreal, with such a vibrant city right next door to the racetrack, Melbourne, there's so many great venues.
You didn't mention Monaco.
Monaco, how can you forget Monaco? So, a phenomenal venue and experience.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how it is to do your job. I mean, you travel like how many days in a year? Like when the season's on, like how many days are you gone?
Yeah, I'm away, I would think about 150 days. So it's a lot of travel. It's a lot of time away from family and loved ones. So it's tough. It's intense. But, it's short intervals. So it's not, we're not going away for a month on end and then, it's in and out.
So you travel for a week around the, I mean, when there's a weekend race, you like arrive in that city like 4 or 5 days ahead of the race?
No, I'd probably arrive on a Thursday night and leave Sunday night.
Okay. Immediately after the race, you're out and then you, okay, so I have a couple of days at home and then off to the next race.
Correct.
Okay. And how much longer can you do that?
I'm still the youngest team principal at Formula One at 48, so okay. I've got a few more years left.
who's the oldest one?
I've got no idea who the oldest one is, but Martin Whitmarsh has just come back and he's got a few miles on the clock now.
So, but I mean, is that your perspective, like doing that for the next 10, 20 years?
I think you have to take it. You can never look too far ahead. I love what I do. I'm happy doing what I'm doing. Certainly for the next 5-6 years, I can't see doing anything else.
I mean, sometimes it feels like a lot hinges on certain decisions. I mean, like right now, Red Bull is really fully committed, it seems, to that sport, to that thing. But I mean, like little tiny things can change within a minute. I mean, if like, for instance, Ferrari, Mercedes, they decide to drop out, it always feels like just reading the news, like it's so much, vulnerability there. Whereas in other sports, it seems more steady. Is that a fair perspective?
I think in any sport, you've got vulnerability in any walk of life. Look at what has happened, in the world over the last 3 years. There's always vulnerability. And that applies to sport as well. I think it applies to any sport.
Like with the whole Corona developments, I mean, that was like a tough time, but I think Formula One came out quite okay, right? I mean, there was only 1 year.
We adapted, we created, worked together to create a calendar and operate and move people around the globe safely. There's very, very few cases that broke out in Formula One. So, and we managed to get a championship going in 2020 and a full championship in 2021. And obviously, hopefully we're over the worst of it now.
Christian, thank you very much for coming on and for giving us an update. How long until the season starts?
We've got about 3 weeks, so we've got one more test in Bahrain, and then we're there for the first race. So the clock is ticking.
Okay. And you think? I mean, there's only one goal, and that's like to defend the championship, right?
Well, we got number one on the car this year. The plan is to try and keep it on there. So it's going to be very, very tough. But I think with the team we have, with the drivers we have, we've got a good chance.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
Der nun folgende Hinweis liegt mir persönlich mehr am Herzen als so manch anderer Hinweis hier. Ganz einfach, weil es um die Europawahl geht am 9. Juni. Erstmalig dürfen auch 16- und 17-jährige Menschen da mitwählen und die Zukunft Europas mitgestalten. Und ich glaube, es ist einfach wahnsinnig wichtig, gerade in dieser krisengeplagten, globalisierten Zeit, dass man ein Gegengewicht hat zu den verschiedenen anderen Mächten auf der Welt. Und zwar am Ende wirtschaftlich, politisch, vielleicht sogar militärisch. Es geht darum, Europa mitzugestalten. Dazu kommt, dass Europa uns einfach wahnsinnig viele Annehmlichkeiten verschafft hat in den letzten Jahren. Sei es nur das problemlose Reisen, den Euro oder das Datenroaming ohne Gebühren. Europa ist trotz aller Kritik einfach der richtige Weg. Und das sieht auch die Hamburger Senatskanzlei so, die diesen Hinweis hier unterstützt, die aber auch verschiedene andere Aktionen unterstützt, die dafür gesorgt haben, dass verschiedene Hamburger Berufsschüler Wahlwerbespots drehen. Diese Menschen werden übrigens auch im Festival präsent sein und dort so EU-Hoodies tragen. Soll ich hier explizit erwähnen, aber es gibt den ganzen Mai über in Hamburg auch die sogenannten Europawochen, einfach um Menschen zu animieren, im Juni wählen zu gehen, am 9. Juni konkret. Ich werde es hier bei uns in der Firma auch versuchen hinzubekommen, alle dazu zu animieren. Es macht einfach total viel Sinn. Mehr Informationen, wenn überhaupt nötig, findet ihr unter hamburg.de/Europawochen oder in den Shownotes dieses Podcasts. Zurück zum Podcast.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.